extreme. There's another danger that probably most of us are more susceptible to, and that's the danger of just retreating into what I would call a respectable Christian life. In other words, not doing anything that attracts the attention of anyone, not engaging in gross sin, running off to Las Vegas with someone, but simply going through life, living a good, respectable life, no longer risking anything for the kingdom, no longer asking, what does God really want me to do? Who does he want me to plug in with? Where does he want me to live? To just pad our ride until the end. This is a question that's relevant to probably everyone here. Except maybe some of you young people are thinking, well, it's just for you old guys that have lived a bit longer and faced life a little longer. But we're just starting out. It's relevant for you too. I'm sure you've had unmet expectations, and some will come. So this is very much relevant for you as well. And the question before us as we face unmet expectations and disappointments is, what will restore our faith and our confidence in God? And the message of the passage this morning is that when your expectations for service and for ministry are dashed, renew your commitment to serve God, because he will fulfill his purposes for you. You know, Elijah's expectations had been dashed. Perhaps you can identify with Elijah in this. Elijah did feel like a failure. Now, there is a little bit of a conundrum in this, because if you've read the previous chapter, you know what happened. Elijah had this incredible victory. He went up on Mount Carmel all alone, faced down the 450 prophets of Baal. God answered with fire from heaven. The 450 prophets were taken down to the brook and slaughtered. And it looked like an incredible victory. But he felt like a failure. He also said to God, there in verse 4, he asked that he might die, saying, "It is enough now, O Lord. Take away my life, for I am no better than my fathers." There's some puzzlement here. Why does Elijah feel like he's a failure, and what is he saying? Let's be clear at the beginning. This is not just physical exhaustion, although that plays a role. More on that in a moment. But let's acknowledge what Elijah's expectations were. Let's try to see what he had expected. Elijah had expected that through his ministry, God would bring the people of Israel back to a wholehearted belief and following and worship of the one true God. Now, the people certainly did return, but they were overawed. If you were vacillating and you saw fire from heaven, what would you say? You would say, "The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God." And that's what the people did. There was a disappointment there. There's also fairly clearly an expectation on the part of Elijah that the prophets would have stood with him. One of the things that Elijah found out in the previous chapter was that there were prophets who still remained. Jezebel had started to kill them. But Obadiah, who was in the king's house, had taken two bands of 50 of the prophets, each band, and hidden them in caves. So he wasn't alone. But when he was on Mount Carmel, who came to join him? No one. And so when he cried out to God, "I am the only one," he had reason to say that. And then Elijah expected that through his ministry, the worship of Baal would be stamped out, not just that the people would come back, but that the whole worship of Baal would be wiped out. And what met him was the messenger of Jezebel, who had established the worship of Baal so effectively in the first place. And she was there, still there, ready to reinstitute the worship of Baal, and she intended to start with Elijah's death. Elijah said that he had been very jealous for God. He said, later on, and we will come to this again, but he said, I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts. He is identifying himself there with Phinehas. Phinehas was the first servant of God who had faced down Baal worship at Peor. And perhaps you remember the story that before the people entered the land, that the Midianites and the Moabites had enticed the people of God to worship Baal. And a man, an Israelite man, brought a Midianite woman into his tent in front of the whole congregation. And a plague started, and Phinehas took a spear, ran into the tent, and stabbed through the bodies of both of them with the spear, killed them both, risking the chance of an endless blood feud, but stopping the plague. And God said that Phinehas was very jealous for him, and he blessed him. But you know, Phinehas killed one of the prophets of Baal, and Baal still lived on. And Elijah killed 450 prophets of Baal, and yet the worship of Baal continued. It was like the Hydra, the Greek mythical monster. One head you cut off, two grew back. You couldn't defeat it by killing it. And Elijah's expectations and hopes and desires were unmet. The sense that his service was in vain, perhaps even a feeling of failure. Expectations can be dashed, and Elijah was facing disappointment in his expectations with God. Know that when you face disappointment in your expectations, that God will minister grace to you. He will minister grace in numerous ways. And the first way that he ministers grace to you is through your body. We are body and soul beings. There's a little play here. And if you want to do something interesting for family worship, I want you to look for pairs of things that happen in this chapter. There are lots of them. We'll note a few of them. There are many more. One of the pairs is a play on the word messenger. The Hebrew word for messenger is malak. It's like it's the same word that's used for an angel. And there are two messengers in this chapter. One is a messenger from Jezebel. The other is a messenger from God. And God sent a messenger to Elijah when he was in the desert, sleeping under a broom tree, a juniper tree. It's a tree with hanging leaves, would provide shade and cover and some relief from the sun. If he were running from someone, it would be a good place to hide, a good place to sleep. And there he was under there needing food, and God sent a messenger and provided food and water for him. He ministered to his body. Now, Elijah needed this because he had been through an incredible ordeal. This contest to death, you can imagine the tenseness of all of this. Will God answer with fire from heaven? And of course he did. After that, Elijah went down and executed 450 prophets of Baal. And you know, it's really easy for us to read that. Let's think for a moment. Imagine you were tasked with carrying out an execution tomorrow morning. How would you feel? And after you had done it, how would it affect you? It would impact your soul and your psyche a great deal. And it would continue on with you for a long time. Now multiply that by 450. And imagine what it might have been. Don't imagine too much. The Bible does draw a veil over it, but as we look at what Elijah was facing, imagine that he had just executed 450 prophets. Let your mind expand on that just a little bit to see what it would have been like. And then he traveled 450 miles. This one's a real stretch for us to imagine. He had gone back and forth between Carmel and Jezreel, and then from Jezreel down to Beersheba, and from Beersheba to Mount Sinai, and then back again to the region east of the Jordan. Can you imagine that traveling? And then there were the threats that hung over his head. And he was in a very difficult state physically as well as emotionally. Depression is a real thing. It is both spiritual and physical. And if you go to a counselor with depression, they will often do what's called a 360 for your life. They want to know everything about your life. They want to know your sleep patterns. They want to know what times, where you work and how many hours you work, what you eat, what kind of recreation you get. They want to know every aspect of your life to get a handle on what's there and to begin to identify what might be contributing to your depression. And sleep has a lot to do with it, of course. Elijah needed sleep. Someone said that our society has been arrogant in the way that we have responded to the body's need for sleep. We've acted like it's not there. It is there. We eat trash. Sometimes we eat too much of it. Fewer people eat too less, but we do not pay close enough attention to regular meal times, perhaps. And recreation. If our recreation goes all in one direction, to the television or to the internet, and there's no exercise with that, what does that do to your body? Know that when God ministers grace to your body in your disappointment, that it really is grace, because you are a body and soul being. And this is a ministry of grace. Recognize that God is doing something to bless you in your body. God ministers grace to your body and to your soul and to your spirit. God ministered grace to Elijah so very clearly here, but it needs some unpacking. Let's look at it carefully. Twice God asked, here's another of those pairs. Twice God asked Elijah, "What are you doing here?" Now, that question alone needs some unpacking, because if you just play the game of emphasizing each word, in other words, to say the phrase over and over again, emphasizing a different word each time, you'll get a very different feel for what it sounds like. What are you doing here? What are you doing here? What are you doing here? What are you doing here, Elijah? So what is it? Is it a rebuke? Is he saying you shouldn't be here? And yet the angel had said to him that their journey is too great for you. It's clear that he expected him to go there. What is God saying here? Well, the words that are used are two Hebrew words. In one sense, they're very Semitic words. At this moment, somewhere in the Arab world, probably 100 places in the Arab world, someone is asking the question that God asked Elijah. It is a very simple question. Ma lek. What is for you? Now, God adds to that, what is for you here, Elijah? But it's a very simple question. And it takes on a range of meaning depending on the circumstances. So, if you have a little fender bender with someone who has just pulled out in front of you, you're likely to get out of the car and yell, Malek, what is for you? What are you doing? And it's pretty clear that it's a rebuke. But if a child comes running into the house crying, mother will pick it up and say, Malek, what is for you? What's wrong? What's happened? And the question is, how is God asking the question? We want to know what he means by it. How did God ask the question? There's a beautiful succession there. God passed by, and there was a wind. But God was not in the wind. And then there was an earthquake. You can imagine the rocks shaking and the sound and the anxiety. God was not in the earthquake. And then there was a fire. And who knows what that was like, but it does not sound peaceful and quiet. It sounds violent. But then at the end of those, there came a fine voice, a small whisper, a gentle wind. It's interpreted in different ways in our different versions. But what kind of question is God asking here? He's asking, Elijah, what's for you here? Malak. Elijah answers twice with exactly the same words. It's something he's thought about. I am not better than my fathers. Phinehas had killed the Baals. He had killed one Baal worshiper, and Baal survived. Elijah had killed 450. Baal still survived. But think of where Elijah is now. He is at Mount Horeb, the mountain of God. And you ask yourself, what was the significance of Mount Horeb? Why did he go there? Well, that was the mount that Elijah went up on to receive the Ten Commandments. It was also the mountain that Moses went up to receive the Ten Commandments. It's also the mountain that Moses returned to plead with God to forgive the people of Israel for the sin of the golden calf, to take them again as his people, to go with them, to tabernacle with them. The worst verse in the Pentateuch was when God said to Moses, go up to the land, but I will not go with you. And that was why Moses returned to Mount Horeb. And God showed grace when Moses returned to Mount Horeb. And he forgave the sin of the people, and he took them, and he tabernacled with them. Moses at that time asked God, show me your glory. And do you remember what God showed to Moses? Imagine that you could show anything that you wanted to show that people would remember you by. Perhaps if you're a pianist, it's your piano playing. Perhaps if you're a doctor, your skills in surgery, the lives that you've saved. Perhaps if you're a soccer player, that goal that you scored. Whatever it is, something that you glory in. What did God glory in? In his judgment? No, it was in his forgiveness. And God said to Moses, I will make all my goodness pass before you. And Elijah is there on Mount Horeb, looking to see the grace of God. And God is showing grace to Elijah. Brothers and sisters, as you minister to others, what are you ministering? You're ministering the grace of God. And in disappointment, one of the dangers is that you begin to believe that God no longer wants to show mercy. If that is at the root of your disappointment, then look to Mount Horeb and see the grace of God, but even more look to the cross of Jesus Christ and know that that was the great declaration, the greatest declaration of all, that God is willing to forgive, and it is his glory to forgive. That's what he wants to show you. And that's the ministry that he's given to you, the ministry of reconciliation. And if you have felt that God just didn't seem to want to reconcile anyone to himself through you as a congregation collectively, through you as an individual, then know that you need this ministry of grace to your spirit, just as Elijah needed it. Return and see that God desires to show mercy, that that is His goodness. Look to the cross of Jesus Christ. And know that God is ministering grace not only to your body, but to your soul. God gives hope. How does He give hope? First of all, He reveals something of His plan. He lets Elijah know what's happening here. God had a plan, and He told Elijah what that plan was. He was going to tear down the worship of Baal, and then He was going to restore from a remnant. This is the doctrine of the remnant, that small group that God would restore His people from. But note that this is not a fast kind of plan. This is a long-term plan, and all you have to do is continue to read the story of Elijah to know that this plan worked its way out over many, many, many years. It was a long-term work. It was a genuine work. But if you read the account, you find also that it was a little bit messy. And you look at it and you think, well, I see God did something here. It's not quite the way I would have done it. I would have scripted it a little differently. And you also look at it and you say, wow, it's not only not the way I would have done it, but the results maybe aren't as good as I had anticipated. But know that it's still a genuine work of God. In this life, the work of God often looks like a messy and mixed business. God also gave a sign to Elijah so that he would know that this was going to happen. He said, I have reserved for myself 7,000 who have not bowed the knee, nor who have kissed Baal. What does it mean to kiss Baal? To kiss Baal was a euphemism for having offered human sacrifice. So if someone went up to another place, to an altar, to worship Baal and came back, someone might say, what did you offer? And instead of saying, my son or my daughter, they might have said, I kissed Baal. That was enough for them to know that they had offered a human sacrifice from someone that they loved, not just someone that they bought from the slave market, but someone that they loved. It's hard to imagine. 7,000 who have not kissed Baal. And here's the sign. God gave, we'll say something more about the work that He gave him to do, but He went down to anoint Elisha. Elisha lived up the creek from where Elijah had been born. He probably knew something about his family. He was excited to go and to anoint Elisha. Elisha had parents. Those parents, first of all, had not kissed Baal. And that was a good thing, otherwise there would be no Elisha. But furthermore, Elisha goes to kiss his parents. What is he doing when he kisses his parents? He's honoring them. Now, when the commandment says, honor your father and mother, a big part of that honoring is to take care of them. Elisha is about to leave the farm, to walk away from that, and to leave his parents. But he doesn't leave them uncared for. His parents still have 11 yoke of oxen to work with, and they can hire it out. But he makes a party for the whole village. And it doesn't say this explicitly here, but it seems that he was saying, I am taking my yoke of oxen, I'm burning my bridges, I'm going on to do what God has called me to do. But can you imagine what he must have said to the people? Take care of my parents. He arranged for their care, made sure that he honored the law. Here was a lawkeeper. Here was some of those 7,000. There was the sign and the hope that God gave. Was it a big sign? No, it was pretty small. Oh, here's one family. Well, there's one family out of that 7,000. God's work is often seems to us to be small. It often seems to be messy. You need to see ministry in the long term, over generations. You need to see it in the present. Look for the signs of what God is doing. And don't say, well, okay, that was nice, but maybe nothing will come of it. acknowledge that to be God's sign in the present and get a right perspective, to know that there is sin in this world, that there will always be difficulty in our ministry to others, but that God is doing a true work and that in His time it will bear fruit. God gives hope, and then God gives work to restore us. There were three things that God gave Elijah to do. He said to him, go, return. We'll come back to those words in a minute. Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. You shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria, and Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint to be king over Israel, and Elisha, the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint to be prophet in your place. There was his work, all outlined in those three appointments. Now, the interesting thing is that Elijah went down from Mount Horeb, returned quite a long distance to east of the Jordan, to Abel-Meholah, found Elisha, and anointed Elisha. If you continue to read, you will see that Elijah never anointed Hazael, but Elisha did. And he did not anoint Jehu. It wasn't even clear that Jehu was really on the scene yet. But he and Elisha trained up the prophets, and it was one of the prophets who went and anointed Jehu to be king over Israel. Elijah did accomplish what God had sent him to do, even though he did not do it personally. He built into the lives of others, and in that building, his work was carried out. This is perhaps not unlike the Psalms, when we read a psalm of Ethan the Ezrahite. And it may be that Ethan lived many years before the psalm was actually finished or composed, but one of the sons of Ethan carried it on, and it was done in his name. And in similar ways, Elisha did a work that was accounted to Elijah, and so did the prophets. Notice the commitment to people. We have such an illustration of it here in this congregation and in Marion as well. Roy Blackwood came to Indianapolis a little over 50 years ago. He had a commitment to the church, a commitment to working with others that are outside of the Reformed Presbyterian Church, because he had a kingdom perspective. He had a commitment to discipleship and to evangelism. And he brought that vision and ministry to Indiana. And he worked in the life of Keith McGill. And Keith McGill passed on that vision to Dave Long, who passed it on to Barry York, who passed it on to Jason Camry. There's good DNA there. And you have a new infusion of DNA. And there's likewise a work of God in Sean's life. God is doing something to bring that work to you here. I don't know Sean's story. I assume you know his story. I look forward to hearing the story of those who have invested in Sean's life and brought him here. But as you ask the question, what would God have me do? What service is God calling me to? Know that part of that must involve investing in lives and hanging in there, persevering, staying with it, even when things don't look like they're going the way that you hoped or the way that you expected. The final thing that God does to restore us to our commitment to serve Him is to fix our eyes on heaven. God fixed Elijah's eyes on heaven, and He fixes your eyes on heaven as well. Elijah said to God when he was under that broom tree, O Lord, take my life. You know, we look at that and we say, well, Jezebel is offering to take your life. What does it matter if Jezebel takes it or God takes it? You know, one way is as good as another. But he's asking for something different. There was one other person in the Old Testament whose life was taken away, and that was Enoch. And you remember that some chapters on, quite a few years later, God took Elijah's life just as he took Enoch. Elijah was not just asking that his life would end. Elijah was asking that God would take him to heaven. You remember what Abraham said as well. And I don't know if he was thinking of Abraham here, but it reminds me very much of Abraham. God said to Abraham, in the face of the promise that Abraham was given, he said to him, "I am your very great reward." And he said that at a time when Abraham wondered if God would fulfill the promise that had been given to him. He believed God, but for all those years, it didn't look like it would happen. God set Abraham's sight on his own presence, which is the heavenly perspective. It's not just a place where we go to drink wine and have 70 wives, at least for the men. I don't know what the women get in Islam. It's not about that. It is the presence of God. And God was turning Elijah's vision away just from service to himself. And so as God gives you work to do and service to do, don't forget that the purpose in all this is to be in the presence of God, to receive his gracious words, "Well done, good and faithful servant." This is the great reward, to be with God himself. This is what we prize more than success. And as we look at our lives and our ministries and we're disappointed, remember that Jesus Christ is your very great reward. God fixes your eyes on heaven, just as he fixed Elijah's eyes on heaven. Your expectations really can be dashed. You can be disappointed in ministry. When that happens, know that God will minister grace to you. He ministers grace to your body. He ministers grace to your soul. And he will give you hope, a sign of his presence and his working today, a sense of what's coming in the future, that he will give you work to do, good work that involves people, that he will fix your eyes on heaven, that he will fix your eyes on himself as your very great reward. So, brothers and sisters, when your expectations are dashed, and your hopes are disappointed, renew your commitment to serve, because God will accomplish all of his purposes in your life. Let's pray.